let's cultivate our motivation. And one of the qualities of our precious human life is the fact that we have encountered the Dharma and teachers and the Sangha who practice it. And from our side, that we have faith and trust in these. And that faith and trust and confidence supports us in learning the Dharma, in applying it to our own mind, in cultivating new habits, in understanding reality. So it can be very helpful to think of the qualities of the Dharma so that we really appreciate having encountered it. And so the real Dharma that we're taking refuge in is the true paths and the true cessations. And so our goal is the true cessations, ceasing both the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive ones, and knowing that there's a state of real freedom that exists that we can attain. And not just real freedom from ourselves, but there exists a state where we can be of the greatest benefit to all living beings and help to lead them on the path to awakening as well. So even though we haven't attained any true cessations now, just knowing that they exist, that they're a possibility, that we have the potential to actualize them, that gives us a lot of hope and a lot of confidence. And it really saves us from despairing while we are still in samsara, because we know that there's an alternative to samsara for ourselves and for everybody else. And then knowing that there's not just the true cessations, but there's an actual path to practice that leads to that true cessation. And the true paths are actually consciousnesses. Yeah, consciousnesses that understand reality, that can cut through the afflictions and their seeds, that can cut through the cognitive obscurations. So these consciousnesses, these realized consciousnesses that know reality exist, and we can cultivate them, we can gain them. And there's teachings that exist that tell us step by step how to do that. So how much more fortunate can we possibly be? Because we've met this these teachings that explain this. So now it's really up to us to use the resources we have to cultivate the paths, to actualize the true cessations, and to do this for the long-term benefit of each and every living being. So with a trust in the refuge objects, the confidence that we can transform our mind, then let's learn the teachings. So one last little bit about conceptual consciousnesses and non-conceptual ones. the non-conceptual consciousnesses alone that perceive just the raw sensory data of an object, they don't create either virtuous or non-virtuous karma. Yeah, it's the conceptual consciousnesses that are the ones that create virtue and non-virtue, because they're the ones that that have mental factors associated with them that are virtue and non-virtue. Okay, so for example, you might think, well, what happens if I choose to watch violent movies? You know, does just watching violent movies, you know, create non-virtue in my mind? It's not the sense data so much that creates non-virtue. It's the thought consciousness that says, I want to watch violent movies because that's entertaining. Okay? Or, you know, I want to watch violent movies because it gives me a sense of power. So it's that thought that precedes the action of turning our sense consciousnesses to the violent movies. It's that thought that creates the dharma, the motivating, creates the karma. It's that thought that is the motivating intention. Okay, so we need to be careful about where we direct our senses. What also can create virtue and non-virtue is after you watch the violent movie, when you think about it and you fantasize being powerful like Spider-Man, you know, and zipping through the air and punching your enemies, you know, you may not, you know, particularly think of yourself dressed like Spider-Man and, you know, going out and doing that. But it arouses in the mind thoughts of violence. Yeah. It increases the familiarity with those kind of mental states. Yeah. And so the mental action of planning how we're going to enact violence, how we're going to retaliate, how we're going to dominate somebody else, that mental action of planning all of this and contemplating it is a negative action. Okay? So that's describing it from the negative side. Also from the positive side, you know, if we have emotions or thoughts of kindness and compassion, and then direct our mind towards watching a certain documentary or reading a certain article or something like that, then the sense consciousnesses that gather that data don't create virtue, but the action of reading or looking or listening, you know, can create virtue if it was motivated by a virtuous thought. Okay, and then similarly, after you watch that or speak about it or whatever, the kinds of thoughts that you have and how it increases your own virtue. Like if you think, okay, I'm going to watch one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's talks on video, and then, you know, so that's a virtuous thought. I want to learn about how to improve myself, how to contribute to the world. So I'm going to watch this. And then you do. So that's a virtuous thought. Yeah. You get the raw data, but then your mind that is thinking about what you hear, how the body language, how His Holiness communicates through body language and so on, and that can create virtuous thoughts and intentions in your own mind to continue to develop those kind of traits within yourself. So that's virtuous mental action in you. And then if you think about what he said and you put it into practice and it changes your speech and your physical actions, then, you know, that is a virtuous verbal and physical karma. Okay? So that kind of completes that chapter where we were talking about the basis of the self, the body and mind. We'll go on now to chapter 4, choosing spiritual mentors and becoming a qualified disciple. So this and the next chapter talk very much about how to rely on a spiritual mentor, how to choose one, how to make ourselves a qualified disciple, and how to rely on the teacher. Now, this is a very confusing topic in the West. At least my experience with it is that people get quite confused about this. And part of it comes from the translation. The Tibetan term is Lama Tenpa. Okay? So Lama means a spiritual mentor, somebody who is heavy in good qualities, weighty in good qualities. Tenpa means to rely on or depend on. So how do you rely on and depend on a spiritual mentor to guide you on the path? Sometimes, or very often actually, this term, Lama Tenpa, is translated as guru devotion. Just that translation term, I think, in the West gives us all sorts of wrong conceptions. Okay? Because we hear the word guru and we think of, you know, there's some lofty, powerful person whose mind is, you know, beyond the beyond. And devotion means, you know, and then we hear this word surrender to the guru. I'm devoted to the guru. I lie myself down on the floor, give up everything, and just worship and devote myself to this person. Okay? It's kind of a magical, mystical idea associated with India. Okay? So just that term, I think, invokes some kind of imagination that is not accurate. Does that term do that to you? Yeah? Get that feeling? So that's why I think translating it more with our feet on the ground as it actually is, which is how to rely and depend on a spiritual mentor, cuts out some of that magical thinking, you know, that we just meet one person and then surrender and lie ourselves flat on the floor, and then that person will manage our lives and will lead us to awakening without us having to do anything except worship and be devoted to them. Okay? So this is the kind of mind that some words can invoke in different people. And that creates a ton of confusion. Okay? So it may invoke that in your mind, it may not. You know, people are quite different. But at least for me, it had that effect. Okay? And it took me many years to actually understand what this whole thing was about. And it was really His Holiness the Dalai Lama's teachings that I find very practical and down to earth that explain how to rely on a spiritual mentor. Okay, so this is His Holiness's book. You'll see for yourself. Okay, so he says, the Dharma is the key to having a meaningful and happy life now and in the future. So the Dharma isn't just to make us happy now. Now this is one difference than of Dharma and psychology that I touched on yesterday. Yeah, psychology isn't thinking about future lives. It's how to be happy now. Dharma is really looking beyond this life. Yeah. So now and in the future. To practice it seriously, two conditions must be present. The external condition is relying on the guidance of a qualified spiritual mentor. The internal condition is a precious human life with the freedom and fortune to practice the Dharma. The stages of the path begin with these two essential topics. Okay, so we have two chapters on the spiritual mentor, a chapter on setting up a meditation session, and then we get into precious human life. Okay, so this and the next chapter address the relationship between a qualified spiritual mentor and a qualified disciple, as well as the importance of those qualities and the methods to cultivate. So notice that His Holiness says, qualified spiritual mentor, okay, and a qualified disciple. Okay, so he's going to go on and describe the qualities of a qualified spiritual mentor. In the West, you know, when we hear that somebody has a certain occupation, we somebody's an accountant, somebody's a doctor, somebody's a plumber, somebody's an electrician. We assume that they've had proper training, and there's usually some kind of licensing process, you know, through which somebody or something checks their work and certifies them, and it, you know, enables us to have confidence in their ability to do their job. Okay, and also in many religions in the West, there's that certification process. You know, if you're a Catholic, you go to seminary, you graduate seminary, you take your vows. You know, before you take your vows, there's a training process. Your superiors decide that you're qualified to take them, okay, and you take them. Similar, you know, with other religions, there's an education process. You get a degree. There's a certification process, okay. As we know with other religions, somebody may be certified, yeah, but they are also a human being with weaknesses, okay? Plumbers and doctors and lawyers and electricians are therapists are certified, but they're also human beings and they make mistakes, okay? But we rely on the certification process. In terms of Buddhism, yeah, there's a certification for your education. You know, if you go to the monastery and you do a program of 20 years in the Gelug tradition, you get a Geshe degree. In the Nyingma and Kagyu tradition, you get a, what's it called? Kenpo. You get a Kenpo degree, okay? In the West, and for Tibetan teachers that come here, there's no certification process, okay? You have the Rinpoches, who are people who have been recognized as incarnations of previous lamas. So you could say, well, that's a certification process, except they were recognized when they were children, yeah? And you don't know what kind of adults they grew up to be. Yeah. And the recognition process can be flawed. Sometimes they recognize the wrong children. You have people who can study and get a Geshe degree, but that doesn't mean they've put into practice everything they've learned intellectually. Okay? So just like the Catholics and the plumbers and the therapists and the accountants, they're human beings also who can make mistakes. Now, some of them, granted, are highly realized and have really put into practice what they've learned and become very qualified spiritual mentors that way. But not all of them. And there's no official, you know, certification process before you come to the West to teach. Okay? Some group invites you, or you decide yourself that you're coming, and that's it. And Buddhism is quite new in the West, so you have a culture, especially in America, we love idolizing people. Yeah? We really, movie stars, what do? You know, sports heroes. Wow. You know, ever since you're a little kid, if I get, you know, I want a baseball signed by, I don't know who the big hero is now, it's no longer Mickey Mantle, but, you know, or Sandy Koufax, but, you know, you want that ball signed by that sponsor, that sports hero. You want a program to a concert signed by Lady Gaga, or I don't know, you know, male Gaga. They should have equal, you know, if you have Barbie, you have Ken, so you should have Lady Gaga and Gentleman Gaga. Okay. But, you know, we want the programmers. We love to idolize them. Yeah. And, of course, we tear them down. In politics, also we idolize. You know, that MAGA cap, wow. You know, I want to take a selfie with, you know, with him. Okay. Or, you know, you're on the other side of the aisle. I want to take a selfie with somebody else, but this person is going to save the world. Okay. So here you have a culture that loves to idolize, to build up, and also likes to tear down and criticize. And you have an Eastern culture who, where the people until 1959 knew almost nothing about the rest of the world. And even when they fled over the mountains into India, they didn't speak Hindi, they didn't speak English. Many of the very well-educated lamas and many of the monks still don't speak English or Hindi, you know, even though they're living in India. The news in Tibetan is limited. Yeah, the Tibetan community is dispersed. They don't really have a daily newspaper. They have some publications, and now there's a TV station that gives Tibetan news and some things on the web. But, you know, if not everybody reads that. So you have a culture that's not familiar with how things happen in the West and the Western mental state. And then those people coming here and us not familiar with their culture. Yeah, so we don't know anything about Tibetan culture. We don't know how to assess a spiritual mentor. We don't know how to rely properly and create a good relationship with a spiritual mentor. So you have two parties coming together, yeah, that don't have an understanding of each other's way of thinking and each other's culture. And so there's going to be some difficulties. Okay? So, you know, His Holiness, and he'll say this later in this chapter or the next, you know, that a lot of the difficulties happen because Buddhism is new in the West. And in Tibetan society, many of the things that happen here wouldn't happen because they don't idolize the teachers so much. Okay? I've talked to some of my Tibetan and Western friends who go to the dialectic school in Dharamsala. And there's Rinpoches that attend that school. And they tell me that in the classes, you know, they debate with the Rinpoches. You know, they treat them just like everybody else. Yeah. Whereas we hear, oh, somebody's a recognized incarnate. Wow. You know, and even, you know, they're 8 years old and we're wowing and bowing. Okay. And Tibetans are not necessarily like that, with the very high lamas, yeah. But aside from that, but even the very high lamas, you know, I thought one of my teachers, you know, who was in Mungo, when he was with the Farallone monks, they treated him just like one of them. Yeah. Somebody like Ling Rinpoche, not so much, but he's like on the, you know, very high level. So in terms of, you know, how they're regarded. And His Holiness is very frank, and it'll say here, he regards a lot of this as social status. Yeah. A Geshe or a Kempo degree is an education degree. Yeah. So there's, you know, at least, you know, somebody's gotten the education. A Rinpoche, he says it's more social status. But even nowadays, the Geshe degree, one of my friends was telling me, if you know, when you enter the monastery, you enter with a class, and your class gets bumped up a grade each year, okay, and you go with your class. So even if you don't really complete all the studies, and you choose to work in the monastery rather than study a lot, you still get bumped up as long as you remain in the monastery with your class. So you can still come out with a Geshe degree. Okay? And there's different levels of Geshe degrees, which most Westerners don't know about, so we don't know, you know, which degree to look for, and so on. Okay? So there's just a lot of it can be very confusing. Yeah. So now, having given you the confusion, let's start to make some sense out of it all and figure out how to rely on a spiritual mentor. Okay, so the first section here says the importance of relying on spiritual mentors. Okay, so it's clearly very important if we want to gain awakening, we need to rely on the people who know the path to do it. Yeah. Otherwise, what we're going to do is we're going to invent our own path. We've been inventing our own path since beginningless time. Look where it's gotten us. Okay. We're still here going round and around and around. So it's very important to rely on a qualified spiritual mentor. Okay, so His Holiness says, when we are seriously interested in following the path, forming a healthy, notice healthy, relationship with a qualified spiritual teacher is essential. If we need teachers for ordinary skills, such as driving a car or learning how to type, we certainly need them for more complex and delicate endeavors, such as transforming our mind into that of a Buddha. Okay. So Tsongkhapa tells us, Tsongkhapa is one of the great Tibetan sages, thus the excellent teacher is the source of all temporary happiness and highest goodness, beginning with the production of a single good quality, and the reduction of a single fault in a student's mind, and eventually encompassing all the knowledge beyond that. So we walk into Buddhism. Of course, we think we're all great, don't we? Yeah. We think we're great. We're actually dum-dums. Yeah. We walk in, And then the teachers have the job of instructing us and training us. Okay. And, you know, we think we're very brilliant, but we're actually kind of lacking. Yeah. So we're very often very resistant. We come asking for teachings and training, and at the same time, we are very resistant to receiving the teachings and the training. Okay. Some of the teachings and trainings we gobble up. And then, especially at the beginning, when you first meet the Dharma, it's like, it's wonderful. Yeah. Then the honeymoon's over. And you begin to realize that the Dharma is pointing out your faults. And your teacher, you know, is aiding in that endeavor. Yeah. What? So, you know, and we don't like people to notice our faults. Yeah. Even if we have them, we certainly don't like them pointed out. Not even in a teaching where the teacher's reading from a text that was written 5 centuries ago. Yeah. We still don't like it. Okay. And especially us Westerners, you know, we kind of come in sometimes, we're, you know, well, I'm a qualified disciple, so I should get the highest teachings. Yeah? I'm educated. I have a, you know, this degree and that degree, and I have this occupation, that training, and I can do this and that. I'm very highly educated. I'm a perfect disciple, very qualified, very open and intelligent and receptive, and I deserve the highest teaching. And then our teacher starts talking about basic ethical conduct, like don't lie, you know, and don't trash other people behind their back, and don't gossip. God, this sounds like Sunday school. You know, don't they realize how, what a qualified disciple I am? You know, I want the highest teachings on the nature of reality, on Tantra, because I am greatly qualified. This stuff, lying, insulting people, that's for babies. Yeah. So we keep on lying and insulting people because we don't want to practice a Dharma that's for babies. But we want the highest teachings that depend on the foundation of having good ethical conduct. Yeah? So this, in the West, is a difficulty, you know, that is often faced. Okay, so what Tsongkhapa is saying is, you know, we really come in, we think we know a lot, we don't. And so the teacher has to train us, and if we let ourselves be trained, then slowly, slowly we cultivate many good qualities. Spiritual teachers, spiritual teachers play a unique and important role in our lives. Qualified spiritual mentors guide us along the path by giving us teachings, Dharma advice, precepts, oral transmissions, and empowerment. When we experience blocks in our practice, they teach us the antidotes to overcome them. When we have spiritual experiences, they help us determine if the experiences were authentic or deceptive. When our practice is progressing well, our spiritual mentors encourage us to continue. The sutta on Half of the Holy Life, relates a conversation between the Buddha and his disciple Ananda about the importance of a spiritual teacher. Thinking that a successful Dharma practice is half due to spiritual teachers and half to one's own effort, Ananda says to the Buddha, "Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life, that is, spiritual friendship, spiritual companionship, spiritual comradeship. While our own effort is undoubtedly essential to emphasize that the spiritual path cannot be actualized without a spiritual mentor," the Buddha replies. Okay, so here's Ananda. He said, half of the holy life is spiritual friendship, spiritual comradeship, spiritual companionship. Ananda replies, and then this whole passage is often misinterpreted in the West, but just listen. "Not so, Ananda, not so." Okay, this, meaning spiritual friendship, spiritual companionship, is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is spiritual friendship, spiritual companionship, spiritual comradeship. When a monastic has a spiritual friend, a spiritual companion, a spiritual comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. By following method two, Ananda, it may be stood how the entire life, an entire holy life, is spiritual friendship, spiritual companionship, spiritual comradeship. Then listen to what the Buddha says. "By relying on me as a spiritual friend, Ananda, beings subject to birth are freed from birth. Beings subject to aging are freed from aging." Make a note that there, that word should be freed rather than feed. "Being subject to death are freed from death. Being subject to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. By this method, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire holy life is spiritual friendship, spiritual companionship, spiritual comradeship." This passage has sometimes been taken out of context and interpreted to mean that having ordinary friends who practice the Dharma is the entire spiritual path. So you will find this in many Dharma publications in the West. You will find this said in many Dharma centers, that we common people who practice the Dharma are the entire, the Buddha said that we are the entire spiritual life relying on each other. Okay? Somebody who says that doesn't know this passage. Okay? Because as holy, the Buddha made it very clear, by relying on me as a spiritual friend. Okay? So the Buddha's not talking about friendship, you know, with your Dharma friends as being the whole of the spiritual path. He's talking about refuge in himself as the fully awakened one, you know, as being the whole of the spiritual path, in the sense that the Buddha has the realizations and the teachings and can teach us how to attain those same realizations, same enlightenment or awakening that he has attained. Okay? Is this clear? Have you heard this? Have you read this in different Buddhist publications or heard it in Dharma centers? No? Really? You have? Okay. I've seen it a lot in Western. Yeah. Buddhist magazines. Yeah. Yeah. It's very often in Buddhist magazines. So, okay. And so this becomes very confusing for people because, you know, they're told sometimes when they go to a center, you know, this is the Sangha. And the Buddha said that spiritual companions are the whole of the life. You know, so we rely on each other. And that's very confusing because not everybody who goes to a Dharma center is even a Buddhist to start with. Not everybody who goes even keeps the basic foundation five precepts. So to call a group of people at a Dharma center a Sangha, yeah, which is a term in Tibetan culture anyway, that is reserved for the monastic community, yeah, then that's very misleading for people, very confusing. Okay? And you can see here the Buddha is very specifically talking about himself as the refuge. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense. And so why does it become confusing? Because there are some Dharma centers, and I have heard directly from people in them, they'll gather, have a teaching or a meditation, and then they all go out to the pub afterwards. Or you have a Dharma center, and so-and-so is sleeping with so-and-so, and that one's sleeping with this one, and the other one's sleeping with somebody else. Yeah. So then people come in and say, this is the Sangha refuge. Yeah. These are the people that are going to lead me to enlightenment. They're the whole of the, they're the entire of the holy life. Yeah, and people go, oh, you know, this is weird. And yes, it is weird because people have misunderstood what the Buddha said here. Okay, so this passage has sometimes been taken out of context and then interpreted to mean that having ordinary friends who practice the Dharma is the entire spiritual life. While having such friends is a boost to our practice, it is clear in the sutra that the Buddha is referring to himself as the spiritual teacher whose spiritual friendship is crucial and must not be neglected. By extension, our spiritual mentors become the virtuous friends that guide us when the Buddha is no longer physically present. In fact, the term geshe in Tibetan, if you translate it literally, means spiritual friend. Yeah. It's used as an education degree now, but translated literally, that's what the term means. In the context of training in samadhi and meditation, Buddhaghosa, one of the great Pali sages, emphasizes the importance of relying on a spiritual teacher. So Buddhaghosa says in the Visuddhimagga, the path to purification, or path of purification, when he dedicates himself to a teacher, he being a disciple, he should say, I relinquish this, my person, to you, Venerable. For one who has not dedicated his person, thus becomes unresponsive to correction, hard to speak to, and not amenable to advice. Or he goes where he likes without asking the teacher. Consequently, the teacher does not help him with either material needs or the Dharma, and does not train him in the scriptures. Failing to get these two kinds of help, he finds no footing in the doctrine, and he soon descends to inappropriate behavior or to the lay state. If he has dedicated his person, he is not unresponsive to correction, does not go about as he likes, is easy to speak to, and lives in dependence on the teacher. He receives the twofold help from the teacher and attains growth, increase, and fulfillment in the doctrine. Okay, So in this passage, yeah, when he's saying when a disciple dedicates himself or herself to a teacher, means that you are a serious student. It doesn't mean you're the Ali Ali Salami, you know, devotion kind of thing. It means that you are serious about practicing the path, okay? And saying, I relinquish this, my person, to you, Venerable, doesn't mean, you know, that I give up my wisdom. Yeah. It's meaning that I am opening my mind to receive the teachings and to be trained and to look at myself and correct what needs to be corrected. Okay? And then he's saying, somebody who doesn't do this, who isn't serious, who doesn't want to really hang in there, then they're kind of cavalier about the whole thing. You know, well, I'm here, and Dharma's kind of nice, and I'll be here as long as I feel like it's good, and I'll be here as long as I like it, and these people better be nice to me. Yeah, and if they're not nice to me, bye-bye. Yeah. And, yeah, or if they're not nice to me, well, I'll just get mad at them and tell them how they should treat me, that they should treat me better, because I am such a great disciple that they should be so happy to have me here. Yeah. So, you know, we have arrogance, don't we? Yeah? So we often come in with that kind of thing. So if that happens, then we become unresponsive to correction. You know, your teacher tries to point something out to you, either to the group, you know, in the teaching, just giving a general teaching, and you go, I didn't hear that. Or, you know, you're being uncooperative, and your teacher says, you know, how about just being cooperative here? Why are you always on my case? You know, so-and-so gets to do that, and you pick on me, and no, I'm not doing it. Blah. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, you think I'm just acting. Yeah. Actually, I was telling, who was I telling? One, I think it was one Chinese nun. It wasn't too long ago. Oh, maybe it was Venerable Hengqing. Anyway, I can't remember. I was telling somebody, you know, that there was a person here for a while. When I asked them to do something, looked me square in the eye and said, no. And, you know, and then I was talking about how I dealt with that person. And this, you know, senior monastic said, you let her stay there? Yeah, you let her stay at the Abbey? And, you know, it was very clear in her mind, you know, somebody who does that, you ask them to leave right away. Yeah, because they're not receptive. Okay. So, yeah, so that person is unresponsive to correction, hard to speak to, always arguing, super sensitive, they think everything's about them, you know, they cry every time you talk to them, or they get mad, you know, not every time, maybe every other time. Yeah, they're not amenable to advice, and they go where they like, you know, or they do what they want. It's like, okay, we have a schedule. You do what you want. You go here, you go there. You don't follow what everybody else is doing. Okay, so consequently, when we're that kind of disciple, what happens? The teacher does not help us. Okay? With either material needs or the Dharma. When you ordain with a teacher, that teacher is responsible for helping you have a place to live and food and for giving you teachings. Okay? Not all teachers follow that, but that's in the Vinaya what it states. But if a disciple is acting like that, then clearly the teacher can't provide material things or the Dharma. The teacher does not train him in the scriptures because the disciple's going all over the place and, you know, doesn't cooperate. And then, you know, if we're that kind of disciple, we don't get the teachings, we want to do our own trip, then what happens? We have no footing in the Dharma, yeah? And we soon descend to inappropriate behavior because we refuse to follow the precepts, so we just do what we want. Or we disrobe, okay? Whereas if we really, have confidence in the teacher and we're really serious about the path, then we're not unresponsive to correction. We don't go around as we like. We're easy to speak to, and we live in dependence on the teacher. When it talks about dependence on the teacher, okay, this is a specific term in the Vinaya, in the monastic discipline. It means that you stay with your teacher for a certain period of time to get trained. You know, you don't just get ordained and then go off and say, well, you know, I got a new hairdo and new clothes, so I must be a holy being now. And, go off and then start presenting yourself as some holy being, which you sometimes see people do because they have not been screened properly before ordination and they have not been taught. And they themselves, you know, are not serious and difficult to teach them. Okay, so we continue. The next section is called Spiritual Mentors. The Sanskrit name for a spiritual mentor is guru or lama in Tibetan. Both of these terms have the connotation of someone heavy with good qualities and superior in spiritual qualities. These terms do not have the connotation of someone being excuse me. These terms do not have the connotation of someone being a living Buddha, for not all gurus are awakened. Yeah, His Holiness is very specific, the term living Buddha, okay? It got coined in China and then projected on Tibetans that these people are, Tibetan lamas, that they are living Buddhas. And His Holiness says, no, we need to get rid of that. You know, these people are not living Buddhas. We should not call them such. We should not see them as such. Yeah, but you still find that term often used in different publications. You know, these Rinpoches are living Buddhas. And some of them, yes, might be, but not as a whole broad class. I've been trying very hard, and Venerable Samten's been helping to find this book that was published. Somebody did their doctoral research, I think in Germany or somewhere in Europe, about tulkus or, you know, Rinpoches, and interviewed a lot of them, and then also His Holiness Dalai Lama wrote the introduction to the book and talked about this whole Tibetan institute, habit of identifying the incarnations of great masters. And His Holiness, again, very clear on what this means, and then the teacher is just talking very frankly. And I remember reading it back in the 80s, and I can't find... we found volume 2, I think, you know. Yeah, but it's really, really interesting, you know, to have that kind of frank discussion about it, and to read about the lives of some of these teachers. So these terms, Lama and Guru, do not have the connotation of someone being a living Buddha, for not all gurus are awakened. If we say that all gurus are Buddhas, there would be some gurus who became Buddhas without working very hard on the path. Mistakenly thinking that all teachers are Buddhas, and later discovering that a certain person lacks all the qualities of an awakened one, not only leaves us disappointed, but always puts the Lama in a difficult situation. The only thing the Lama can do then is just shake his head because he lacks all of a Buddha's qualities. Therefore, it makes more sense to follow the real connotation of the term Lama and Guru, because genuine spiritual teachers have superior qualities in comparison to their followers. Okay. Being a Dharma teacher depends on other people wanting to take that person as their teacher. In Tibet in the past, a person did not become a teacher by being appointed by some authority. Rather, through diligent training, a person became a good practitioner. A small group of students who saw that person's qualities asked him to teach. As those students practiced and developed good qualities, others gained respect for the teacher, and gradually that person became known as a great teacher. Okay? So in old Tibet, this is how it was done. People saw somebody and they checked that person out. They saw they had good behavior. They knew the Dharma. They requested them to teach. Okay? So it was the students who make that person into the teacher, not the teacher saying, "Here I am." You know, it's the students doing that. And then because the students studied with that teacher and practiced well, other people saw that, and the proof of the pudding is, you know, what you see. And so because their disciples practiced well, then more people wanted to study with those teachers because they thought, you know, if I study with those teachers, I'll become like those disciples. Okay, and so that's how people became teachers. And in the monasteries, it still pretty much works that way. Okay, but in the West, it doesn't. Okay, some teachers come to the West, they're chosen by, they're asked by their teachers to come to the West and teach. Yeah, so some teachers are like that. Other teachers, they just want to come to the West. You know, when you grow up in India and you're a refugee, coming to the West is, you know, good food, comfortable place. So, you know, they want to come to the West, and then somebody comes along who says, "Oh, they must be a living Buddha, you know, and I'm going to sponsor this person to come to the West." Or you find one young woman who says, "I'm going to marry them, and then I'll be married to this holy person," and brings them to the West. And then that person kind of gets set up as a teacher, yeah, without necessarily having the qualities of one. Okay, like I said, some do, but some don't. Okay. Similarly, nowadays in monasteries, the process of becoming a teacher occurs within the monastic structure. So monastics study for their Geshe or Kempo degree. Students in the lower classes then ask the new Geshes and Kempos, who are respected for their learning, understanding, and memorization, to teach. When students benefit from the explanations and guidance of the new Geshes and Kempos, they become known as good teachers, and other monastics are eager to attend their classes. Okay? So it's through a process of, you know, a very organic process. Yeah, not a process of somebody putting themselves up as a teacher. Okay, but in the contemporary secular world, teacher connotes someone in an academic field who, after completing certain requirements, is certified as a teacher by an organization, whether or not that person has any students. Okay, as only it says, perhaps in the West that model would be better, but that is for Westerners to determine. Yeah, so some people say, well, yeah, let's set up, an organization, have exams to test some of these people, see if they know the Dharma well. They have to complete, so many hours of being trained under a teacher, and their behavior is scrutinized, and then they get certified. Yeah, so some people are saying, maybe we need to do that kind of process. I don't know, because, I'm a leftover hippie. And, too much structure like this is not necessarily my style. Okay. So in that case, His Holiness says, Buddhists could form an organization that certifies people as teachers after examining their Dharma understanding as well as their personal conduct. However, an organization cannot certify someone's spiritual attainments. So this is my problem with that, setting up that kind of system. Okay, an organization cannot certify someone's spiritual attainments. So issuing certificates attesting to attainment of spiritual realization or level of the path does not make sense. In any case, it is not necessary to be a realized master to teach at a Dharma center. A good education in Buddhism, personal integrity, and genuine care for the student's well-being are sufficient. Okay, so you need a good education. You need personal integrity. You need to keep whatever level of precepts you have. Okay, and have some ethical conduct and genuine care for the student's well-being. In other words, the students are not there to wait on you and to give you money and to go around exclaiming how glorious you are to the world. Yeah. The teacher has responsibility to genuinely care for the student's well-being. Although we are the ones who choose our spiritual mentors, there are certain conditions under which someone becomes one of our teachers. For example, if they give us refuge in the five precepts, monastic ordination, the bodhisattva ethical restraints, or tantric empowerment. For this reason, it is necessary that we check the person's qualifications before attending these ceremonies and do not rush blindly into things. Okay? But in general, even in this situation, we're the ones who decide who our teachers are. Yeah. You may have somebody come up to you, and I've met people who this has happened to, and teachers say, we have a connection from our past life, or you've been the disciple that I've been waiting for. And then, of course, we love that, don't we? I'm the special disciple that my teacher is waiting for. We have karmic connections of past lives, and he recognizes me, so I must be special. We love that. Yeah. But there's some drawbacks. I met one man in Mexico. This happened to him with Charlatananda. Yeah. Some charlatan guru who, I think a Hindu one, who came and said, you're the disciple I've been waiting for. You are going to help me, and we're going to set up something big. And this person who has a PhD in physics, okay, was just wowed by this guru until, and followed him and did all these things, until he realized that this guru was sexually abusing his two teenage daughters. And then he went, what did I get myself into? Yeah. So that comes, you know, by letting ourselves be wowed instead of having our feet on the ground and checking things out properly, you know, using our own wisdom. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an extreme example, but I met, you know, one person who told me that story. Okay. Buddhism is spreading to countries where it has not existed before, and there it encounters different cultural values and ways of doing things. The model of a spiritual mentor-disciple relationship that has existed for centuries in Asia does not easily transplant into a secular modern society. Okay? Traditional spiritual mentors and contemporary students raised in secular societies both enter into a student-teacher relationship with expectations that they may not be aware of. Okay? So the teacher may say, well, this person must be serious on the path, and the student may say, wow, this is a living Buddha. Yeah? And it's difficult because this role in previous times, you know, if in general, not always, but in general, if you were really serious, then you were ordained. Yeah, there's this whole yogic tradition and so on. But they also got a very good education too. But now what we have in the West, and it's starting to happen in Asia more too, is lay people wanting to do a more serious practice. In older times, and in some countries still, very much in traditional Asian societies, the role of the monastic is to learn and to practice and teach. The role of the lay person is to, you know, take the five precepts, keep them, and make offerings, you know, and do a small meditation practice. But basically the role of the lay people is to make offerings and to support the monastic community. But what we're having now is lay people coming in and saying, I want to have more advanced teachings and I want to be more serious in my practice. Okay? So then here's a teacher who grew up in a monastery who's expecting their students to be monastics. And you know, monastics who grew up in the same culture as they did. And you have Westerners who are coming in and saying, well, you know, I don't want to ordain because I don't want to, you know, there's too many rules and I don't want to follow those rules. And, you know, some of them, you know, basic Sunday school morality, maybe I'll do a little bit of as it pleases me after I go to the pub, after the teachings. You know, but I'm exaggerating here, but there are people with this attitude, yeah? So, you know, so you're getting people coming in with certain expectations on both sides, and the expectations aren't correct, okay? So, yeah. Okay, in traditional Tibetan Buddhist monasteries, there are many types of teachers. Some are like parents who look after the physical well-being of young monastics, teach them the alphabet, and guide them in appropriate behavior in the monastery. More advanced students teach the lower-level debate and philosophy classes. Geshes teach the more advanced classes, while Rinpoches, both lay and ordained, and some Geshes give empowerments and tantric teachings. Tibetan monastics and lay followers relate to these people differently according to that role in that individual's practice. Their standing in the monastery and their reputation in Tibetan society. When Tibetans go to other countries, people in the Dharma centers do not necessarily know what kind of teacher is coming. And out of respect, they treat everyone as though they were a highly esteemed lama. This can create misunderstandings. Okay, so in the monasteries, they take in little kids starting at age 5 or 6. The parents will give their kids to the monastery. You usually give your kid to, to a relative who is a monastic in the monastery. You know, an uncle, a cousin. The Tibetans really have extended families and they know all these relatives. I don't know how many generations out. But they'll give their child to that person. Yeah, that person becomes their genla. Genla means teacher. So their teacher, what does the teacher do? Make sure that they know how to put on their robes, make sure they eat properly and take their vitamins, make sure they go to bed and get enough sleep, make sure that they grow up to be a polite person. Essentially, their genla becomes like their parent. I was recently talking to one Western Geshe, and he was telling me that in the monastery, because he was a member of the Tibetan monastery, they gave him a little boy to raise. Yeah, so, because this is what happens. Everybody gets a kid. And he referred to that child as his son. And he said, you form that kind of bond with the child that you're raising. So this little boy was brought to him at age 5. And, you know, my friend who's the monk, who never thought of having kids, is all of a sudden a father and raising this child. And so even though now this Geshe lives in the West, every week he calls the monastery and he talks to his quote-quote son, who he's raising. Yeah. And so that's the way they do it. And it's very organic because, like I said, usually it's a relative or it's somebody from the same locale in Tibet that your family comes from. So there's a feeling of community, kinship, relationship. You go into something where you know people and you're cared for as a little kid, and you're brought up, okay? So there's that genla. Yeah. That genla is like a father, you know, or a mother in the nunneries, but they don't relate to their genla as they would to His Holiness Dalai Lama, okay? Then when they get involved, when they start taking classes, then like His Holiness says, the monks that have, done some study, they teach the lower level classes. And then as the monks progress through the classes, the monks who are in the higher classes teach them, okay? And then when it comes to taking tantric initiation, it's usually His Holiness, usually one of the Rinpoches who do that, sometimes Geshes. But usually the Rinpoches are the ones who give that, the empowerments and the tantric teachings. And so they act towards these different kinds of teachers very differently. Yeah. In the West, somebody comes, if they're Tibetan and a man and wearing robes, people say, this person's a Buddha. Yeah. And they treat them, you know, of course you wanna get in good with the Buddha. But you know, you wanna make offerings to the Buddha. So what do? You take the monk to the shopping center. And he wants a Rolex watch, you know? So you get him a Rolex watch, one of the gold ones, you know? Or he needs this or that or the other thing. And you get him that. And in this way, the Westerners spoil some of these monks who are not the high Geshe's, who are not the high Rinpoche's, or even who are, they come to the West and they think everybody in the West is rich because everybody will take them to the shopping center and buy them stuff because they think that person is a holy being. Okay? So I'm giving you all the downside. You know, this is a teaching you will never get from a Tibetan. Okay? They will tell you, see the guru as the Buddha. Okay? I'm kind of giving it from a more cultural perspective. But this is what often happens. Okay? And that's why His Holiness is explaining here that in a Tibetan monastery, you don't treat all your teachers the same way, and you don't regard them all the same way, because they play different roles in your life. Some are like daddy, some are like, you know, your high school teachers, some are like your college professor, some are, you know, like really your spiritual, the person who inspires you spiritually and really conveys to you that it's possible to gain attainments. And so the Tibetans react towards all these different people in their lives in a very different way. Yeah. But we don't know any of this. Somebody comes here, we don't know their background. And our culture, like I said, we like to worship people. And so that's what we do. And then it isn't really fair to the teachers, I think, because sometimes then they get really the wrong idea about the West, and that everybody is rich, everybody will give them money, you know. And that's not the reality of the situation, is it? Okay. Okay. Let me just read the next paragraph, because there he's teaching what we just read about the traditional Tibetan monasteries. Okay. Now he goes on and he says, the expectations for a secular teacher and a Dharma teacher differ greatly. In a secular educational facility, students trust that the school hires competent teachers. They often do not choose their teachers. If they need to attend a required class, students take it from whoever is teaching it. Okay? And, you know, you're not told to have faith in your academic professor as a holy being with great qualities, you know. They're just your professor, that's it. Yeah, they may inspire you a lot, which is wonderful, and be a real mentor for you. Yeah. But it doesn't happen with every class you take. So in the secular world, the teacher's job is to impart information and knowledge. They seldom get involved in a student's personal development as a human being. So what you do when you go to a class, your teacher doesn't know what you do when you're not in the class, and it's none of their business, okay? If you are upset about something and need some guidance, you may go to one of your professors or teachers and ask them for help. Yeah, but that's completely up to the students, and the professors are not at all responsible for character development or, you know, making sure their students have good ethical conduct or anything. Okay, in a secular setting, students who are experiencing difficulties are usually referred to a school counselor. Students in colleges and universities pay to attend, and they fill out evaluation forms of the classes and the teachers at the end of the semester. Yeah, so you pay. You know, and you evaluate as part of, you know, because you paid. Teachers are hired employees in a paid position who can be fired if their work or behavior is not up to standard. Teachers and students do not live together, and after the semester is done, they go their separate ways. But in a Tibetan monastery, you live with your teacher. Yeah, and you know what your teacher does all the time, practically. And they know what you do all the time, practically. You know, and it's a very close relationship. So it's extremely difficult and different than a secular relationship with a teacher. Okay. In the past, children in secular schools were taught to respect their teachers. But depending on the country, that is often not the case nowadays, especially in American schools. I can really tell when I'm abroad and I'm invited into an American school. You know, the kids, they're sitting in the hallway. They won't even move their legs when you walk down the hallway. You know? The American kids are just like talking as loud as they want, being rambunctious. You know, you go into another international school, you know, run by another country, the behavior of the students is completely different. Yeah. Anyway, that's our culture here. Yeah. Okay, but depending on the country, that is often not the case nowadays. The advent of online classes has changed the teacher-student relationship even more, so that teachers and students may never even meet in person. The teacher's job is to plan the curriculum and assess the student's assimilation of knowledge. The student's job is to learn the material and tell the teacher what they already know in a test. There is little sense of personal connection to each other, the other person simply being a name or a face on the computer screen. Okay. A relationship with a Dharma teacher, here meaning a qualified spiritual mentor who teaches the sutras and commentaries, is different. The focus of this relationship is not only the conveyance of knowledge, but also character building. This is important. The teacher is responsible for guiding students spiritually over time so that they become ethical, kind, and wise human beings with the correct understanding of the Buddha's teaching and the ability to meditate on those teachings. Okay? So you can see the relationship with the spiritual mentor is very different than what we usually think of as a relationship with a teacher. Yeah. So it's not the usual relationship, but it's also not the magical, you know, I'm in the presence of this Buddha, and they bless me, and all my hair stood on end, and I got a blessing. You know, I'm being dramatic, but I've seen this happen too. Okay? So let's stop here. I've already gone over time. Yeah, we'll come back here, but just to get you thinking about, you know, how do you relate to your secular teachers? How do you relate to Dharma teachers? You know, and how do you construct idols and then have grandiose expectations out of them, for them?